I would like to acknowledge a couple of birthdays this morning. One of the truly great and gracious ladies in this city is Mrs. Royal Thompson, Juanita Thompson, who is the mother of Marilyn Ritchie. Not long ago, she was 93. When you can get to be 93 and look as beautiful as she does, you have achieved one of life's great triumphs. We're happy for her. There are three young women in the balcony who would not be there had it not been for the birthday some years ago of one of the choir members, well known to me, whose birthday is today, and who will tell you, if she chooses, which birthday it is. I am not about to make that mistake. When I started a series of sermons on the seven deadly sins, the sins that were categorized by the medieval church, I told you about a mnemonic device I learned in college to help me remember those sins. The word gleeps, G-L-E-A-P-S-C. Those interested parties who are writing it down, it is G-L-E-A-P-S-C, the last word being covetousness. It's a nonsense word, but one you never forget once you've used it. And in that word, the first sin is gluttony, which we talked about first. And the second is lust, which I decided to delay for a while after some of us revealed more interest in that topic than in all the rest combined. Not that this would make us much different from most other people. I just saw the November issue of Harper's Magazine, whose editor had invited different advertising agencies to do promotional ads for the seven deadly sins as a joke, just to see what kind of copy they would write and what kinds of pictures they would use. And sure enough, the editor says, every agency picked lust. So the magazine had to assign the topics. The one on lust showed a famous painting of sexual conquest, and then wrote above it, any sin that's enabled us to survive centuries of war, death, pestilence, and famine can't be called deadly. And underneath is an additional caption which asks a question. Lust. Where would we be without it? The answer is obvious. Extinct. So no wonder we are preoccupied with this one. Through war, famine, and plague, it has kept the earth populated, which is exactly how nature intended it to work. Some of you may remember an ad that used to appear on television in which a woman dressed in a long white robe stands in a forest, raises her arms, and after a flash of lightning and a clap of thunder, says, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. Never mind that she's angry because a certain margarine is being passed off as butter. Her message can be a graphic warning about the power of natural instincts, one of which is the sexual appetite, which comes with being human and which has, like all instincts, a certain blindness to it. The force that draws men and women together, that guarantees the survival of the race, is powerful and primitive. By itself, nature does not care who the partner is, or whether you stay with him or her, or whether or not this union promises anything more than a passing physical satisfaction. Nature has one blind and compelling motive: to perpetuate the species. What you do with the rest of it is your problem, not hers. And yet the idea that Mother Nature has to be controlled in some ways runs through the literature of every great civilization. Behind every single one of the seven deadly sins lies something that is, first of all, good. Good to eat. Bad to be a glutton. Good to be angry sometimes. Bad to be angry too much or for the wrong reasons. Good to be ambitious. Bad to be greedy. Good to have the feelings that make you look at someone and say, wow. Bad to behave in ways that earn you the ugly title, lecher. We have wonderful jokes about the first response. We don't find the second very funny at all. And we do know the difference, even if the dictionary doesn't help us much. When we can joke about lust, we are defining it to mean anything from appreciation of physical charm to powerful sexual desire. But it has other connotations that make it ugly, so that we don't even like the sound of the word. When it means lechery, which is another ugly word, we stop joking when desire becomes undiscriminating and totally selfish, out of control, the cause of harm and heartbreak, not good. You notice how quiet it is? How carefully people are listening? I may have made you nod off on envy and greed, but not this morning. I mentioned the seven deadly sins to a college boy last week, and he said with perfect sincerity, I didn't know there were seven deadly sins. What are the other six? Even apart from this context, you would have known what he meant. Now, isn't it odd, when you consider how preoccupied we are with this topic and how blatantly modern advertising exploits it to sell everything from cars to can openers, isn't it odd that we are so much harsher with people who violate our rules of sexual behavior than we are with any other kind of stumbling? We know what our closest friends have confessed to us, and we know our own fantasies, which we haven't dared confess to anyone, and yet most of us feel deliciously superior when we can find someone who has lost a round in this particular matchup with nature. I'm grateful the New Testament records a moment when Jesus ran into this self-righteous attitude, because I like to remember how he reacted to it. You may recall that curious scene in which a hard-breathing posse of pious gentlemen, swollen to the eyeballs with a sense of their own goodness, came before Jesus ready to stone to death a woman they had caught having an affair. Jesus did not tell the woman she was blameless, but it's obvious that his real anger is for the hypocritical bunch so eager to punish her. I think he sensed in them what a modern psychologist would call the projection of their own secret guilt feelings upon a convenient and helpless object. So he said to them, let the one among you who is without sin cast the first stone. And then he stooped down to look at the ground for a bit while they thought it over. I don't think he meant just any old sin. I think he meant if any of you gentlemen has never lusted in thought, if not in deed, then pick up your rocks and start throwing. And as they thought it over, the story says, one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the youngest, they went away. The priority interests me. Beginning at the oldest, in those in whom it might be thought the fires of passion had at last cooled, and coming down to the youngest, and every single one of them making the tacit admission that maybe he didn't have any business throwing bricks after all. It would be my guess that on their way to find that woman, these vigilantes had passed several dozen of Jerusalem's leading crooks, men who had spent the day cheating widows out of their homes and defrauding the poor in the marketplace. But that hadn't stirred our friends, even for a moment, to preach and punish. The thing that excited them, the weakness they felt a holy urge to penalize, was the sexual hunger that had driven some poor creature into arms that promised love. Does that tell you anything about them that would make you want to know them better? It's an interesting commentary on our attitude toward sex to consider what we have done to the word immorality. It used to be a general word covering all kinds of character defects, but today it usually means only one thing. Let a newspaper story say that a man or woman is immoral, and 99 out of every 100 readers will think of only one thing, and with rising excitement: that he has slept in the wrong bed, or that she has some unconventional sexual life that promises spicy reading. A person can be greedy and selfish, spiteful and cruel, jealous and unjust, unscrupulous and full of lies, arrogant, stupid, and dead to every noble instinct, and still it might not occur to us to call that person immoral. We save that word for people who falter in one particular way: a teacher can absolutely mutilate the personalities of his students every single day for 30 years and still be kept on the payroll. He may be opinionated, hateful, biased toward minorities, a male chauvinist who intimidates the girls in his classes. He may be sloppy in preparation, cheating students and parents of what they paid for. He may set for them every single day an example of both indolence and ignorance, and it is still unlikely that anyone will provoke a great public outcry or that the board will interfere to fire him. But let him register in the wrong company one night at a motel, and if the public finds out, it will cry passionately for his immediate dismissal. Tolerant of all those other abuses that hurt them and their children so much, they rise in holy wrath when his private life is, at least once, not what the rules dictate. I say these things because this is all stunningly different from the way Jesus looked at our lives. Please don't misunderstand either what I am saying right now or what he did. He did not take lightly sexual behavior which did harm to oneself or to others. He was far too deeply concerned with the interplay of mind, body, and spirit to do that. But his most scalding rebukes always were against sins of the disposition, the very ones we tolerate longest in the deacon, the elder, the minister. If those people are petty and vicious, full of secret hates, and eaten up with envy, we deplore it, but we do nothing. If they slip sexually, we are on the phone in an instant. We buzz over coffee. We sharpen the hatchet with a glee that is almost erotic in itself. I'll try to make it so clear, there can be no doubt of what I mean. Our attitude toward the person who responds in some wrong way to this particular temptation is often uglier in the view of Christ than the failure itself. Somewhere along the way, we upset the apple cart, because the only times Jesus blazed up in passionate anger was when he found someone cheating the helpless poor, or so proud of his own goodness that he was literally choking on it. With weakness of the flesh, he was as gentle as love and healing required. With sins of the disposition, he was tough and unyielding. And once you see that clearly, you have no trouble understanding why he told certain arrogant leaders one day that prostitutes and outlaws would go into the kingdom of heaven before they would. But even while I say these things, I realize what blatant casualness we have created in these final years of the 20th century about sex. We are bombarded with the word that if it feels good, we ought to do it, when no single philosophy of life has ever been more destructive than that. The slogan, "Do your own thing," depending on how it is meant and practiced, can be the silliest piece of nonsense ever spoken. There is no such thing as a valuable life without discipline. If you think the unrestrained life of the senses leads to anything good, find yourself an aging Don Juan and take a long, hard look at him. He and his brothers, who pass from one conquest to another, forgetting last night as quickly as they forgot the night before, have one characteristic in common. Off their beat, they are dull, dull, dull. And they grow coarse. Because to play that game, you have to dull your sensitivity to what others are, to what is owed to them, and to what they feel. Sad, restless, tragically unfulfilled, these people are, and one long penetrating look into their eyes is enough to put the Playboy philosophy out of business. The church fathers of early centuries were wrong to act as if sex were unclean, to be talked about only with embarrassment, shame, and guilt. But in the great swing of the pendulum, it is equally ludicrous that modern life is drenched and saturated with sex as if nothing happened in a person's life of equal importance. If our grandparents draped a shroud around sex and whispered behind their hands, we have created for it a makeshift halo and fallen down to worship it. If we're going to fool Mother Nature, sometimes, when she starts pushing us in ways that can be blind and dangerous, we need all the help we can get. Sometimes, Nothing works better than a good joke, a touch of wit, to remind us that we have minds as well as bodies. A touch of compassion to remind us that we are human together. An honest admission, for example, of how hard it may be for an old rake to turn over a new leaf. And better than anything else, those quiet demonstrations, now and then, of rich and disciplined lives filled with love. Lives which preach better than any sermon that if desire was meant to save our kind, the love that can follow desire was meant to make us worth saving. Amen.